Oh, hi, Spoken Web Podcast Project Manager, Stacey Copeland here. How are you? I wanted to take a moment to let you know we are looking for contributors from across the Spoken Web network to pitch and produce episodes with us for the 2020 season. All Spoken Web team and network affiliates can submit episodes, no podcasting or audio experience necessary. Do you have a great archival find or current project you'd like to showcase? Ever wanted to interview a fellow colleague or Canadian poet? Our team is here to support you every step of the way, from episode idea to editing to final production. So send us your pitch and get in touch at spokenwebpodcast@gmail.com. That's spokenwebpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. And now back to our regularly scheduled programming.
Projection to do it.
What does literature sound like? What stories will we hear if we listen to the archive? Welcome to the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds. My name is Hannah McGregor, and each month, I'll be bringing you different stories of Canadian literary history and our contemporary responses to it, created by scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. You might know poet Gwendolyn McEwen as the winner of the 1969 Governor General's Award for her collection, The Shadowmaker, or the 1987 Governor General, posthumously, for Afterworlds. She's also maybe one of the most significant Canadian poets whose work is entirely out of print. McEwen was only 46 when she died, and her tragic life, combined with the mysticism of her poetic voice, has made her a figure of enduring fascination for other poets and scholars. At the same time, her work's deviation from popular narratives of Canadian literature has often led to her being dropped from our literary histories. In this episode, I'm inviting you to join me, as well as authors Jen Sukfong Lee and Andrea Bennett, and Spoken Web researcher Catherine McLeod, as we reflect on why McEwen's voice continues to haunt us. Here is, again, me, Hannah McGregor, with The Voice is Intact.
Have you ever heard her read?
No, I've never heard her voice.
Oh my God, do you want it?
Yeah!
A fugitive from all those truths which are too true. The great clawing ones and the fire breathers. The ones that rake the flesh like piranhas. And those that crush the bones to chalk. And those that bare their red teeth in the night.
So melodious, her voice.
My mind emulates
I never dragon, used the word melodious.
Fish and snake. And shoots fire to melt the Arctic night.
So ASMR,
or chews
though.
Off the edges of continents. Or wraps itself around
it. The ribs
of the world.
I knew it. She
world.
Had to have a voice like that. She couldn't write these poems in. Without that voice.
Something that will come up often when presenting about McEwen, and certainly in conference sorts of settings, where people really want to hear her voice. And if you talk about McEwen and don't play her voice, then people are really aware, like, wait, we want to hear her voice. But then to also think about the layers of mediation and copyright and all the things that that also are distancing us from her voice and being aware of that too.
The voices you're hearing belong to academic Catherine McLeod.
I'm Catherine McLeod, and I'm an affiliate researcher with Spoken Web at Concordia University.
And author Jen Sukfong Lee.
I have been trolling Margaret Atwood since 1997. Big props to me.
You might recognize Catherine from earlier episodes of the Spoken Web podcast. She's a Montreal-based scholar of Canadian literature with a focus on sound, performance, and archives, and the co-editor of the new book, Canlit Across Media, Unarchiving the Literary Event. She's also the curator of Spoken Web's Audio of the Week series. Jen Sukfong Lee is a Vancouver-based writer, radio broadcaster, and podcaster. She's the author of The Conjoined, the co-editor of Whatever Gets You Through, 12 Survivors on Life After Sexual Assault, and the co-host of the podcast Can't Lit.
Once the monster's jaws unfolded fire.
And that third voice you're hearing is Gwendolyn McEwen, reading on November 18th, 1966, as part of the Sir George Williams Poetry Series, held between 1965 and 1974 at what was then the Sir George Williams University and is now Concordia University. The audio recordings of this reading series are at the heart of the Spoken Web Partnership and form a rich and exciting digital archive that has already inspired significant scholarship on the history of the poetry reading. But I'm not interested in this reading series. I'm interested in McEwen.
The first time I discovered Gwendolyn McEwen, it was probably reading Dark Pines Underwater in an anthology. And I think it was. It was Oxford University Press, edited by Margaret Atwood, of course. Because back then everything was edited by Margaret Atwood. Yeah, and it was Dark Pines Underwater. And I think it was only one poem that was anthologized in there. And I read it. I must have been 17 or 18.
This land, like a mirror, turns you inward. And you become a forest in a furtive lake.
And that poem, which people say is about Canada, right? Like, I think you and I were just discussing this before we turned these mics on. But they say it's about Canada, but I read it as being this, like, fear of the internal and sort of the fear of the gothicness that lives inside us that we only see in reflection, upon reflection, in reflection.
The dark pines of your mind reach downward. You dream in the green of your time. Your memory is a row of sinking pines.
And there was enough in that poem for me to want to read more of her work.
Explorer, you tell yourself this is not what you came for, although it is good here and green.
Actually, when you mentioned your master's, that was the first time I learned of McEwen was during my master's degree out at UBC out west in Vancouver. And I was in a course with Cheryl Grace, and it was a CanLit graduate course. And we were thinking about autobiography. And we read the play by Linda Griffiths, Alien Creature, A Visitation by Gwendolyn McEwen. And in the play, Linda Griffiths uses McEwen's words to conjure the presence of McEwen as this magical poet and really to think about kind of really the reflection of the self through a poet's words and a poet's presence. And so I actually ended up writing about that play. And that was my first academic publication, was about Linda Griffiths's play about Gwendolyn McEwen, sort of the presence of the voice in the play and sort of a mediation of McEwen in that way. But it was back in my master's too. So it's sort of this long, McEwen has always been there.
You know, and I took these books off my bookshelf. There's, you know, pictures of her on it. And she had these huge, like, sad eyes, big, sad, you know, like that movie Big Eyes. It's like that kind of thing. And I realized that, like, every poem I've ever read of hers, her eyes are there. Like, they're there somewhere. There's a lot of looking, a lot of vision, a lot of dark vision, you know.
It really was the voice of her poetry, the sound of her poetry, the way she's able to conjure up a presence through the words themselves. And I think a lot of her poetry actually has to do with haunting. There's this sort of this continuation that's really evoked in her poetry, and a strengthened voice that you can hear from the words on the page, I would argue, even though it's fascinating then to think that what often captures people is hearing McEwen herself read the poems, and then whenever someone's able to listen to McEwen reading her poetry,
but mark now how harmless are the claws,
is something that just captures one's attention. And she's able to create a real strong sense of voice in her poetry, and then when it's read out loud, it's even more powerful.
I can't remember the first time I heard Gwendolyn McEwen's voice, but I remember that I first heard her work read out loud by a friend. And I know that I was excited enough about her 1982 poetry collection, the T.E. Lawrence poems, that I initially planned on writing about it in my dissertation before the practicalities of putting together a research project led me elsewhere. Actually, despite the fact that McEwen was one of the authors who led me to the study of Canadian literature, I've never written about her formally. This podcast episode is the closest I've come. McEwen was born in Toronto in 1941 and rose to fame quickly and young. She published her first collection of poetry in 1961 and won the Governor General's Award for her fourth, The Shadow Maker, in 1969 when she was not yet 30 years old. She died young too, at 46, And the combination of her fascination with mysticism and the almost mythically tragic shape of her own life have turned her into a somewhat mythic figure in her own right.
No, she was deeply social, and she was as famous as poets get, really, in Canada ever. Like, she's a bit of a rock star. Like, she started doing things like having, like, a signature black eyeliner situation and, like, signature clothing, like, loose, silky things. I mean, come on, man. I wish I had, like, a signature look.
But this iconic status was no accident. McEwen came into her own as a poet in a historical moment when it was possible to be both a poet and a celebrity, and her poetic persona was very much tied to the culture of poetry readings in the 1960s, perhaps most notably at the Bohemian Embassy, an alternative club in Toronto where she would meet poets like Jay McPherson, Margaret Avison, Phyllis Webb, Al Purdy, Leonard Cohen, Irving Layton, and Milton Acorn.
Well, I'll start again. Like, thinking about McEwen also allows you to think about spaces for performances of poetry, thinking about, say, the Bohemian Embassy in Toronto. You know, it's talked about how McEwen would show up to the Bohemian Embassy and there would be the sounds of, like, the coffee maker in the background and all these, you know, poets maybe reading with these, like, loud, bombastic voices or however poetry, you know, the poet's voice was thought of. And then this woman's coming up to the microphone and she's often talked about as appearing very quiet and suddenly just absolutely captivating the audience. And I was so drawn to the fact that somebody very sort of unassuming could have such an impact and just call everyone's attention. And it also then it allows you to think about what it meant to be performing as a poet, a particularly very young female poet at the time that McEwen started doing her readings and being up there with a young Margaret Atwood and all the rest of the 1960s poets, just how she held her own on that stage, too.
In fact, it's impossible for me to think about the historical context that shaped McEwen's work without thinking about that poetry scene of the 1960s and how central it was to the invention of that thing we now think of as Canlit. And when I think of McEwen and the poet she would become, the poet who would write the T.E. Lawrence poems and Afterworlds, collections that have haunted me as long as I can remember, I keep coming back to those years in the early 60s, to what happened to her then. And I'm not the only one.
I also think about the way that she was so determined to be a poet. And there's something about that, again, thinking of, you know, what models did she have to look to be a female poet in Canada at the time? Really, she had to sort of forge her path of what that looked like and what that sounded like and trying to sort of find her place and her voice, the space for her voice in that world. She was in the circles with so many of the very loudest male poets at the time and still managed, you know, she managed to be known for the strength of her voice, but it sounded incredibly difficult too. And I was very interested in how she managed that and what she had to fight against in order for her voice to be heard. You know, who was this person, Gwendolyn McEwen? You know, what kind of work could she have produced if she was in a more sustainable environment for her writing? You know, can we learn something from that now, or are we still struggling against the very same things?
I often wonder sometimes when, because she wrote a lot of her work after this was done, like most, the bulk of her work after that marriage was over. And like, there's a part of me that sometimes thinks those things that she's trying to access is maybe that marriage. Like, I wonder sometimes, right? Because like, when you get married or you're in a relationship when you're really young, like I got married really young. I met my ex-husband at 21. I was married at 24. By no means was that like an imbalanced marriage. I would never say that. But it defines you, I think. Like in your 20s, you're exploring things. You don't know who you are. Your identity is so malleable. So what did Milton Acorn, what did he try to shape her into? And what did she end up taking on? And what did she end up rejecting would be my question. And I don't think any of us will ever know this answer. But then looking at her poetry, I sometimes wonder if that darkness is there. And that in the way she would sort of like, as we were saying, she was not ever writing in the voices of men who were like loud, big, you know, masculine men, always the opposite. And to me, that's kind of a gentle pushback against that Milton Acorn angry bear.
As I was working on this episode, I reached out online for someone who could help me better understand McEwen's relationship with the poet Milton Acorn and how it might have shaped her work. My answer came serendipitously in the form of an essay by writer Andrea Bennett from their new book, Like a Boy But Not a Boy, Navigating Life, Mental Health, and Parenthood Outside the Gender Binary, which is available for pre-order now from Arsenal Pulp Press. With their permission, here's an excerpt from the essay, The People's Poetry. In the early 1960s, a part bar, part coffee shop, part venue space opened on St. Nicholas Street, a few blocks up from Yonge and Wellesley in Toronto. Soon after it opened, poet Milton Acorn, then in his late 30s, began to hold court there. The embassy held poetry readings on Thursday nights, when Acorn would read, generally overstaying his welcome on the stage. Afterwards, Acorn would find himself surrounded by younger poets, many of them students from the University of Toronto. Margaret Atwood, then a student at the University of Toronto, read at the embassy. A little later, a teenage Gwendolyn McEwen found the spot, the community, Acorn. Acorn was bombastic, drank a lot, often had a fat cigar sticking out from the side of his mouth. McEwen was slight and half his age, but had a compelling voice of her own. Unlike many of her contemporaries, she wasn't at university. She was self-taught, had had a tumultuous, occasionally violent, marked by alcoholism and mental illness, home life. Many of the books that chronicle Acorn and McEwen's relationship come close to saying that Acorn was something of a father figure for the younger poets gathered at the embassy, dispensing poetic advice, maybe acting more like a big brother. Acorn started off as McEwen's poetic mentor, but their relationship soon morphed and they began to date. Eventually, they married. This was something Acorn wanted, and McEwen initially did not. He'd proposed in December 1960 when she was 19 and he was 37, and she'd said no, writing, "Milt, my love is not the same as yours. I feel no need to find myself physically, sensually, emotionally in another person. I'm still getting acquainted with life, with myself." However, she agreed to his proposal a little later. He was in Prince Edward Island for the winter, and she was missing him while he was away. Acorn and McEwen's friends speculated about why they had gotten together at all. Chris Gudgeon's biography of Milton Acorn, Out of This World, says people referred to them as Beauty and the Beast. It was easy to see why Acorn was drawn to McEwen. She was young, beautiful, talented, and insecure. McEwen, Gudgeon writes, quote, "fed Milt's lopsided vision of himself as a heroic poet knight, battling the dragons of injustice and leaving the fair maiden swooning," end quote. Another Acorn biographer, Richard Lem, is more explicit, quote, "he had a constant companion who would listen to his political discourses, a sexually experienced man he could teach and savor his less experienced lover," end quote. Although it was less clear what had drawn McEwen, one friend from the embassy pointed out that when they met, in contrast to later on, Acorn seemed confident, strong, clean-shaven, eccentric but put together. Acorn and McEwen had friends who guessed that part of the reason she'd been attracted to him was career-related. She was ambitious and saw him as established, a way to further her writing and publishing goals. Al Purdy thought, quote, "Gwen was with Milton because Milton was getting attention," end quote. Rosemary Sullivan, McEwen's biographer, writes that it's important to be careful about the way we think about McEwen and Acorn's relationship in retrospect. There was a power imbalance, and the relationship seemed doomed from the start, and Acorn was persistent, but there's no evidence that he was abusive, either physically or emotionally. At least, not until the relationship crumbled. McEwen took a solo trip to Israel a few months after her wedding. When she returned, the distance and solitude had given her a new perspective on Toronto and her relationship. As Sullivan puts it in Shadowmaker, quote, "almost as soon as she had married, Gwendolyn recognized that she had made a terrible mistake," end quote. McEwen wanted a marriage of equals, and Acorn wanted a wife. Acorn was deeply conservative at heart, homophobic, anti-abortion, he wrote at least one terrible poem about it, and he wanted to see supper on the table every night. McEwen and Acorn had an open marriage. He'd taken advantage of this when she was away, and she began a side relationship with a painter when she returned from Israel. Acorn gave her an ultimatum, him or the painter, and not even a year into their marriage, she chose to leave. It was a choice that Acorn could not brook. He fell apart. He drank. He showed up on friends' doorsteps in the middle of the night, distraught and drunk. He wrote McEwen angry, bitter letters. Quote, "one letter from that time begins with, 'you dirty bitch,' and ends up asking, 'where in the world did you learn to be such a louse?'" end quote, writes Gudgeon. Another, quoted in Shadowmaker, sent after McEwen told Acorn of her intentions to divorce him, quote, accuses her of being the great North American castrator, end quote. McEwen wrote back, at least at the beginning, explaining herself, trying to make him understand. Reading their biographies, the snippets of his letters that make it through, it appears as though Acorn's life had fallen apart, and he'd set the blame squarely on the shoulders of his much younger ex, who simply wanted space, freedom, and an amicable divorce. When Acorn refused to give her a divorce, in the era before no-fault divorces, McEwen was forced to travel across the country, to Vancouver, to gather evidence of his marital infidelity in order to petition the courts. Purdy, who'd been Acorn's best man at the wedding, reluctantly acted as a witness to Acorn's adultery so that McEwen could finally break free of the marriage. In 1969, years later, McEwen and Acorn were both announced finalists alongside George Bowering for the Governor General's Literary Award for Poetry or Drama. Acorn was still a mess, outstaying his welcome at friends' houses, drinking, not bathing, suicidal, hospitalized for depression, still half hoping McEwen might come back, and blaming her for everything that was wrong in his life. When McEwen found out her book, The Shadowmaker, was shortlisted alongside Acorn's I've Tasted My Blood, Nick Mount writes in his book Arrival, the story of Canlit, quote, she was afraid enough of him to write to the judges that if there was any chance of her having to share the award with Acorn, she would rather withdraw her book from consideration, end quote. But she and Bowering won, and Acorn didn't. Canlit did not graciously accept McEwen and Bowering's wins. Instead, poets Irving Layton and Eli Mandel co-authored an open letter protesting Acorn's loss. The letter was in part a call for money to be raised and, quote, presented to Milton Acorn as the Canadian Poets Award, end quote. Another public plea for Acorn, this time an editorial by poets Seymour Main and Ken Hertz in a now-defunct Montreal literary magazine, reads, quote, either because of literary politics or a gross ignorance of Canadian poetry on the part of the Canada Council jury, Milton Acorn has been denied the Governor General's award that he truly has earned, end quote. Acorn's supporters generally focused their ire at Bowering. One of the three jurors who'd chosen McEwen's and Bowering's books over Acorn's was Warren Tallman, an American who'd been hired to teach English at the University of British Columbia. The thinking went that Bowering's style, which was influenced by U.S. poets, was emblematic of a type of cultural imperialism that needed to be studiously avoided if Canlit was to be its own proper national cultural project. 5 days after McEwen and Bowering were feted at their awards ceremony in Ottawa, a broad swath of Canlit, including Layton, Purdy, and Atwood, showed up at Grossman's Tavern on Spadina Avenue in Toronto to witness Acorn receive a check for $1,000 and a medallion naming him the People's Poet. When I think of this night, Acorn got so drunk he lost the medallion twice, his friends let him read for 40 minutes, he was roundly celebrated, I immediately picture McEwen and wonder how she felt, if she was at home in her small apartment that night, if there was anyone with her. And I wonder if anyone at Grossman's thought about McEwen. Did they wonder, celebrating Acorn, if they were enacting a deeper injustice by attempting to address a perceived one? If McEwen wasn't quite part of that new Canlit scene represented at the People's Poetry Party at Grossman's Tavern, maybe it was because she also wasn't part of the project of building a thing that looked recognizably like Canlit.
That white male sort of masculine sort of like, yeah, like the, it's the Milton Acorn narrative. She just didn't care. She just was like, I don't care. You guys go fight it out in your huts with your potatoes and axes. I gotta go to Egypt, get some bomb black eyeliner. See you later.
And perhaps it's something about her poetic rejection of accepted nationalist narratives, those potatoes and axes that Jen alludes to, that make her appeal to those who are a little skeptical about essentialist stories about what it means to be a Canadian, or for literature to be Canadian.
I think there's a lot of pressure for authenticity, and I think it's a marketing thing in many ways. I think that in my experiences writing for both big publishers and small presses, that the big publishers understand that a certain amount of authenticity sells doesn't even really matter if you're writing fiction. Like if you're somebody like who looks like me and you're writing a family story about a Chinese Canadian family, then the authenticity is easy to sell. It's easy to sell. It's like, well, Jen's real grandfather was also a barber or whatever. You know, it's very much a merging of self, brand, and book.
And her lack of investment in those narratives can help to pry open spaces to think about alternative ways of organizing our literary history.
In the history of Canada, for me anyway, like I'm not a historian by any stretch. The only history of Canada that I'm familiar with, like in any deep way, is the history of Chinese Canadians. And for most of that time that there were white settlers on this land, there were also Chinese Canadian, usually indentured laborers. And I don't think the garrison mentality... How many times can I say that on this recording?
Oh, garrison mentality, for those who don't know, is a term that was coined by literary critic Northrop Frye and kind of popularized by Margaret Atwood's literary critical writing, which essentially argues that one of the major themes in Canadian literature is anxiety about the dangers and emptiness and threats of the Canadian landscape.
It doesn't suit their experiences of... let's just say being chased off a gold claim, doing laundry for the railway workers, being a railway worker, being abandoned by the railway and not having passage home, scouring the woods for the remains of your friends so you can send them back home for a proper burial. Where is garrison mentality in that? It's not the land that has destroyed them. It's the white people. So like there's an alternative there. And I think that any sort of marginalized group who has, you know, been alongside the white settlers all this time could very well choose their own anthology that would support that narrative. And wouldn't that be interesting?
This isn't to say there's nothing Canlit-esque about McEwen's poetry career. In fact, McEwen had a strong, if often largely functional, tie to the CBC. As Catherine McLeod explains, it began with a prize.
Gwendolyn McEwen won the CBC Poetry Prize in 1965. And at that point, she was very young, a very young poet. And through winning the prize, she got the attention of Robert Weaver, who was then the producer and editor of the program Anthology, which was a CBC literary program that, you know, ran from the mid-50s up until 1985. So a very long-standing literary program. And Robert Weaver became a really strong supporter of Gwendolyn's work. So he had her on to read on Anthology shortly after winning the CBC Prize. And she then read on Anthology numerous times, but also started to write radio plays. So the one that she's most well known for is the play Terror and Erebus, that is all about the Franklin Expedition and the Northwest Passage. And she wrote two more, but which aren't as well known, but that the play Terror and Erebus was broadcast in the mid-60s and, you know, rebroadcast, and both by writing the plays and also reading for CBC, she was able to make a bit of money, which the reading on CBC and writing for CBC ended up being a way that she was able to support herself, again, continuing that sense of, you know, wanting to really be a poet and be self-sustaining in that way. So one of the programs that I uncovered that I thought was one of the most fascinating when I was listening to McEwen's readings on CBC in the 60s was a program that she produced and created for Anthology that was broadcast in 1969. And it was called Gwendolyn McEwen Introduces. And I've been thinking a lot about how this program Gwendolyn McEwen Introduces from 1969 is an opportunity for her to talk about other poets and other works that she's interested in. So it was this moment of listening in the archives and expecting that, okay, maybe this is going to be another reading by McEwen, which are fantastic and captivating. But in this case, she was talking about other poets. It was actually a four-part series. And that's where the last episode of that four-part series I was most surprised by, because that's where she started to talk about flamenco. And that is where I nearly fell out of my seat, because I was so thrilled and amazed that here I was in the CBC archives listening to McEwen, who I was fascinated by and working on. And at the same time, I have been cultivating my own dance practice in flamenco throughout my academic work for the past 15 years. And here I was listening to McEwen talk about flamenco. And in this past year with Dr. Emily Murphy, who's an assistant professor at UBC Okanagan, we've started a research creation project that lets me perform some of these recordings back from this 1969 piece and bring in the flamenco side to it. So Gwendolyn McEwen's interest in flamenco, there's all kinds of connections between McEwen and music, and especially the sort of the Toronto world music in the 60s and artists that were passing through. This continues into the 70s and is a whole other story of McEwen and her partner in the 70s opening the Trojan Horse Cafe and connections to musicians passing through and performing there. But back to the 60s. I'm trying to figure out where she would have heard it or how she would have first been drawn to flamenco, but it makes a lot of sense because there's something indescribable about the sound of her voice and this feeling almost like the duende of flamenco, which is a word that refers to this indescribable sense that when you're just really moved by something. And McEwen's program, part four of Gwendolyn McEwen Introduces, is all focused on the duende. And she's interested in thinking about the duende as it's theorized in Spanish poetry and then in flamenco as this indescribable feeling of the depths of your soul and true feeling and emotion. She's interested in how we could understand that in poetry. And she's thinking about poetry outside of Canada, but then she starts to sort of reflect a little bit more on Canadian poetry. And she asks the question, where is the duende in Canadian poetry? Which I just find fascinating because where she turns, I think, goes back to her trying to figure out where her voice sits in Canadian poetry, because the person she turns to as an example is Irving Layton. And it's so when we, you know, we're thinking about what kind of models or what is she thinking about when she's thinking about Canadian poetry that is moving. On the one hand, yes, I see why she talks about Layton's poetry, but I found it fascinating that she didn't give her own poetry as the example, because I would argue that her poetry has the duende. Her poetry is the poetry that moves you and the poetry that has that indescribable feeling. So in listening to the piece, it was really interesting to hear her theorize all of this, but also not see herself in that. And then that's when I started to think, okay, as a critic, how can I argue that McEwen has the duende? And one of the ways that I feel like is most successful in arguing this is, in fact, to dance her poetry.
I should have predicted the death of this city. I could have predicted it if only there had been no such pretty flowers, no such squares filled with horses and their golden riders.
Catherine's work on Canadian poetry and flamenco, and Jen's imagining of alternative anthologies that reject the garrison mentalities, settler colonial meta-narratives of Canadian writing, both point in different ways to how McEwen's Poetics can lead us away from received notions of what Canadian poetry is or can be. And as I think about ways that those of us who care for her work can keep McEwen's contributions alive, I come back to her voice, so powerful that it feels fully present as I listen to it.
This one really affected me when I was like 19. I don't trust you for a single second, but my bones turn gold and your hands warm holding in the dark or in the bright heart of the morning. And suddenly the days are longer than anything, longer than Tolstoy, longer than Proust, longer than anything. But the days are also diving into night. And I told you our end lay in our beginning, so we drink to our end, always remembering that at the bottom of the goblets of Pompeii was the skull. We crawl out of the night utterly broken, bruises all over our souls, but this pain returns me to the world. Even in the end, your perfidy serves me. So the cry we made when we came, love, will sound the same and is the same as the cry we will make when we go. She knew she was going to die young, I think. Yeah. I think I'll love her forever. And I think she never disappoints. Every time you go back, you're still like, wow. There's always something else there, because whatever is happening in our world or the things that we're most consumed with, there will always be an element of that in her poems. Those are the kind of poems that she wrote. They were everything and everywhere.
Playing a recording of her reading, it sounds so live and sounds so present. She's still in motion. She's still alive. She's not in the archive. She's not in a box. She's still here and very present, thinking of the lines from Past and Future Ghosts. Look out, you who inhabit those rooms of my future. I'm coming after you. I'm starting to haunt you. I'm starting right now.
Phyllis and I had a great idea that if our voices gave out, we were just going to open up the record and bring a recorder up on stage and place the needle in the proper groove and then just let the record speak for itself. However, I guess the voice is intact.
Spoken Web is a monthly podcast produced by the Spoken Web team as part of distributing the audio collected from and created using Canadian Literary Archival recordings found at universities across Canada. I was the producer this month. Thanks so much to Stacey Copeland, Spoken Web podcast project manager and producer extraordinaire, for all her help. A special thank you to Jen Sukfungli, Catherine McLeod, and Andrea Bennett for their generous contributions to this episode. To find out more about Spoken Web, visit spokenweb.ca and subscribe to the Spoken Web podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may listen. If you love us, let us know. Rate us and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or say hi on our social media at Spoken Web Canada. And we'll see you back here next month for another episode of the Spoken Web podcast, stories about how literature sounds.